Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. Welcome to All Exits Closed. My guest today is Howie Hawkins, and Howie had run for the governor's spot on the Green Party line, and Howie's here to talk about the Green Party and student loan debt. So, hi, Howie. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you.
So I'm sure you've been following what the presidential candidates have been saying. So it doesn't seem as if not any of them are addressing student loan debt. And, you know, so many people dislike Trump and they want to vote for a Democrat. But the Democrats aren't even embracing this student loan debt. So in the last presidential race, Jill Stein made that an issue. Can you briefly talk about what she tried to, you know, talk about and how it resonated?
Sure. Well, yeah, I haven't heard a word from the Democratic candidates or from Donald Trump. And we're talking about $1.5 trillion in debt.
Yep.
That is just an albatross upon, you know, people that have gone to college. And instead of starting their lives, getting married, buying a house, buying furniture, all those things, they're paying off student debt.
Mm-hmm.
And what makes it worse is that by, you know, bipartisan support, they passed a bankruptcy law back in, well, it was before Obama got elected. He voted for it. And so did Joe Biden, that excludes student debt as a way to go into bankruptcy. So it's a real burden. And so in 2016, Jill Stein said, you know, the government should just take over those debts and forgive it for the students. And
mm-hmm.
it resonated with, you know, a lot of young people, for sure. I would prefer a ability to pay way of getting out of this. And that would mean, you know, students would pay something on the debts they have based on ability to pay, like a percentage of their income. And after 20 years of doing that, everything would be forgiven. That way you're not having, you know, somebody who's making, you know, minimum wage and paying taxes to the federal government bailing out a Harvard graduate that went to work for Goldman Sachs. So
mm-hmm.
I think that's a fairer way to do it, and it will also be more acceptable to people. Because I did run into, as you know, 2016 went on, people did say, well, why should I bail out some rich kid? And I think that's a legitimate concern.
You know, what I find so disconcerting about the whole thing is me as a baby boomer, when I went to college, there was no such thing as student debt. Nobody has a tremendous amount of debt, but now everybody does. And it's like the federal government and the banks have imprisoned all these people, and I believe there's no such thing as upward mobility anymore. They're trapped. They're trapped forever. And I think it was deliberate. What do you think about that?
Well, they certainly cut back on supporting public colleges. And so the public colleges raised their tuition. And worse than that, they didn't just raise it to cover the cost of instruction. They did a lot of building. They added a lot of administrative positions at high salaries. You know, people just like in the private sector, the top management is making outsized incomes. So a lot of the colleges, you know, they say to compete to get the good people from the private sector, they had to raise salaries too. So I think not all of the increase in costs that students are paying went to their education. It went to supporting this bureaucracy that's got out of hand. And also, you know, they, you know, the building, I guess this is because the colleges compete for students to apply. It's got really fancy. I mean, when I went to college, we didn't even have a student union where I went. You know, it was, there were dorm rooms and there were classrooms and there was a gym, and that was pretty much it.
Mm-hmm. Mm. So I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought.
Well, let me add a thought then.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I think another thing that has happened, and this is you know, sort of been highlighted recently with this scandal of rich people buying their way into elite colleges, is that education, instead of being a good in its own right, you know, so that people become well-educated citizens so they can make smart choices, and well-educated consumers and workers so they can take care of themselves at work and in the marketplace, it's become the substitute for really having policies that reduce inequality. And so this rat race, you know, with education, you know, the schools are, you know, there's a hierarchy of schools, so you go to the good school, you get the better jobs. Everybody's using education to climb a hierarchy that could be compressed a lot if we had policies, for example, to reduce income inequality at the point of production in the first place, like a minimum wage that kept pace with productivity in stronger unions. And worker co-ops where the workers themselves appropriate and decide how to spend the net income or profit between bonuses for them or reinvestment in the co-op, you know, to buy new equipment or whatever. We can also have more equality by having more social provision of collective goods and services. You know, Medicare for all, public housing, tuition-free public education from pre-K, you know, that's the whole crisis of child care, to college. And then, of course, more progressive taxation. There have been a lot of reforms as this inequality has grown that have reduced the progressivity of both corporate and personal income taxes.
Now, what I learned from the crisis that that has taken brought to light in the last couple of weeks is the fact that wealthy people know that college is a stepping stone to something better. But when you're middle class or you're poor and you take out loans and you graduate in the hundreds and thousands of dollars in debt, you're not going to be upward mobile because you're going to be faced with debt for the rest of your life. So I think that to me, it's like the rich have shut out the poor and the middle class, and the rich kids are the ones that benefit most from this. What do you think?
Well, I think that's exactly right. You get people like Jared Kushner, who apparently got bought into Harvard with, I think it was a $2.5 million donation from his father. And even while he was at Harvard, he was in the real estate business, which, you know, because land values improve with public investments, it's unearned income that can then be used as collateral for more loans. So people like him are making money from basically predatory housing and predatory lending to the people that have to borrow to go to college, and when they graduate have to rent a place to have a place to live, and they're paying more for both than they really should. And it's going to that top 1%. It's really going predominantly to the top 1,000th, the 1/10 of 1%. They've made the lion's share of gains in the increase in incomes and distribution of wealth over the last 40 years.
Well, I know that Jill Stein had made a issue of the student loan debt crisis, and she talked about, you know, all over the country, but yet it didn't resonate. Is that because millennials do not vote, or because the press did not cover it well enough?
Well, I think those are factors, but it's also a lot of people were voting against Trump who would have liked to have voted for Jill Stein. So they voted for Hillary Clinton because they saw Trump as the greater evil. And it's understandable. I mean, Trump is an open racist. He's a freeloading leech. He doesn't pay his taxes. He doesn't pay his workers. He doesn't pay his contractors. You know, he's a hypocrite. He hires illegal immigrants when he's, you know, basically making racist comments about immigrants. Mm-hmm. And every time he opens his mouth, he lies. So it's understandable why people didn't want him to be president and thought they'll hold their nose and vote for Hillary Clinton, even though they liked what Jill Stein was saying. I think that accounts for most of the fact that of those people who did get to hear what she was saying and liked it, they still didn't vote for her.
So do you think it'll be different next time around?
No, I think it'll be more intense. I mean, the broad center left, you know, all they got on their mind is getting Trump out of there. The problem is that the Democrats don't have solutions to everything from the student loan crisis to the climate crisis. And, you know, real solutions can't wait. So I'm sure the Greens will have a candidate and we will be out there, you know, trying to get real solutions on the table. And, you know, I have some encouragement in that respect, in that the Green New Deal, which I and other Greens have campaigned on for a decade, is now something that Congress is voting on as a non-binding resolution. But at mm-hmm. least it's being widely discussed, which gives the Greens a platform on which to speak about a real Green New Deal. Because what's been put on the table by, you know, Senator Markey and Representative Ocasio-Cortez is somewhat watered down from what the Greens have been talking about. So,
uh-huh.
but they've opened the discussion. I'll give them credit. And the Sunrise Movement, those young people have, you know, forced it into the public attention with actions like they're sitting at Pelosi's office. So
right.
I think, you know, there'll be opportunities for a green ticket to advance the discussion and enable, make sure that the Democrats, I mean, the Democrats should win this election. I mean, Trump's never had high favorables and they've been declining somewhat recently. And given all he's done or not done, they should beat him in a landslide. But hopefully there's enough people voting for the Greens that the Democrats have to take note. Like when I got 5% in 2014 running against Trump, Cuomo, who
uh-huh.
wouldn't take a position on fracking, and that was like the probably the lead demand that had the most support, had the most resonance with people.
Uh-huh.
Cuomo had to, like, when the health department said it wouldn't be good for the water, he gave him the excuse to say, okay, we won't frack in the state. Of course, when the Democrats
uh-huh.
do what you say, they don't really do it. So now we're flooding the state with frack gas imported from Pennsylvania to fire
right.
new gas-fired power plants. So that's why the Greens need to keep at it.
And the other side of the coin is the 44 million Americans with student debt. I am surprised that they are so quiet. I'm surprised there's no rioting in the streets. That's so.
Well, in our culture, we tend to think that our problems are just our personal problems and not social problems that require collective action and solutions. So I think a lot of people are, you know, suffering in quiet and thinking they're at fault when there are, as you say, 44 million people got in the same situation given the opportunity structure that this society offers. So, you know, the thing we got to do is help those people understand that they're not in this alone and that there are solutions, like, you know, the student loan fund I was talking about where, you know, they would pay back on a schedule according to ability to pay and then be forgiven after 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And we can also offer, again, like we used to in most in many states, free public higher education so that people can get a college education without going into debt.
Do you think the media is partly to blame?
Yeah, I think they can only handle one issue at a time. So, you know, it's all Trump all the time now on cable news. At least Fox
mm-hmm.
put some other things in, but they do a lot of Trump defending. And so, you know, they're really important stories that don't get the coverage they should. And, you know, the Trump coverage is important, and the scandals, they're important. But it doesn't mean every hour, you know, for the whole hour, you got to have talking heads there repeating themselves as to what happened and what they think about it. And, you know, we need to cover other issues as well.
So, and for 2020, the Green Party candidate for president, will student loans? I know, Howie, that you do the Green New Deal, and that's important, is the environment. But so is people indebted to the banks, and they see no way out of it. Do you think the Green Party in 2020 will make that a major issue?
Of course. And for us, the Green New Deal is not just climate action, although that's a centerpiece of it. It's also fulfilling the Economic Bill of Rights that Franklin Roosevelt called for in his last State of the Union address in 1944, saying everybody ought to have the right to a living wage job or an income above poverty, decent housing, comprehensive health care, and a good education. So under a good education, that involves free public education from pre-K through college. And for those that go to private colleges, a student loan fund where they would pay back based on ability to pay. In other words, it should be government funding with the aim of breaking even, not gouging people and making a big profit for shareholders, which is what the private banks do when they underwrite it. Right now, the government, you know, a lot of the loans are guaranteed by the government instead of coming directly from the government. Although the government does own a large portion of them, which is why they could play a big role in getting that debt forgiven for the people who are now in debt. You know, basically Congress would have to buy the debt, and then you'd set up a payment plan like the student loan fund I'm describing.
But, you know, I was speaking to somebody who went to SUNY Albany back in the late 60s, and they didn't have – the campus wasn't as big as it is now, and, you know, with the buildings and stuff like that. So does the public have a right to say, hey, we don't want this debt and we don't want that building? What do you think?
Yeah, well, I think on a case-by-case basis, they certainly have the right to say that. And, you know, I know there's a private university here in Syracuse University, and they redid a street through the middle of the campus, which was, you know, made the street a nice walking mall instead of, you know, for cars. But it cost a lot of money, and I remember the students up there saying, you know, put this money in the scholarships. So certainly, and they had every right to do that.
Okay. What do you think it's going to take for people to get off the couch and demand action by the feds and by the banks?
Well, in my experience, it's always a small group of people that agitate on these issues. And they feel like they're not making any progress because they aren't getting a lot of people to join with them. But what I've found is actually they are getting people to agree with them, but people don't come out in large numbers unless they think it'll make a difference. And so something happens that just sort of a public opinion switches. You know, like the anti-Vietnam War. The people protesting, we had some sizable demonstrations from 65 through 67. And in the fall of 67, it got pretty big. But then the Tet Offensive in January 1968, it seemed to flip public opinion, or a lot of it. Because after that, you know, the demonstrations really got massive. And it became clear to people like Nixon, who was running for president, that the war was not supported. So he had his secret peace plan, which was basically to, you know, threaten North Vietnam with nukes. But, you know, public opinion switched then. I've seen this in the anti-apartheid movement, the anti-nuclear movement, the movement against the war in Iraq. In that case, it was, you know, how bad it was going after, you know, we were told that people would, you know, throw roses at us, you know, that kind of thing. So I think, you know, that's how people get off the couch, is when they see a lot of other people getting off the couch. And exactly when that happens is it's hard to predict. But the important thing is that the advocates keep advocating and educating. And they'll be changing minds even if people aren't showing it to you right at first. But at some point, if you've got, you know, a reasonable position and people agree with you, there'll be a reason for them to come out. And it's usually when they see a bunch of other people. And it's usually some event that kind of triggers it. So everybody says, oh, I can come out. It'll make a difference. And I won't. So I think that's why people are on the couch right now.
In years gone by, the Democratic Party was thought of as the working man's party. That's no longer the case. They're tied into the elite power structure with the money and stuff. So why hasn't that resonated back down to the electorate? Why every single cycle over and over again, why don't they come to believe that the Democratic Party is not going to come to their rescue?
Well, I think a lot of working people have already concluded that, and they're not voting for Trump. They're sitting these elections out. So that's where most of the abstention comes. It comes from working class people, you know, the bottom 60% of the income spectrum. The base of the Democratic Party is the middle class, upper middle class. That's the mass base. You know, suburban, managerial professional types, people on salaries. And that's why, you know, they're when they talk about, say, the equality question, they talk about diversity and basically integrating a grossly unequal society at the upper levels is their idea of being progressive.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't speak to working people who are not getting ahead. Our wages have been stagnant for over 40 years, and the rent is going up, and healthcare costs are going up faster than inflation, faster than our wages. So the Democrats, that's why people abstain, because the Democrats don't really speak to those issues, most of them. I think, you know, people like Bernie Sanders does, and I don't think he goes far enough, but, you know, that's why I think he gets a good response. So, you know, the Democrats are funded by the super rich and voted for by the upper middle class, and they appeal to the progressive wing of the upper middle class. And the Republicans got their super rich, and the conservative wing, the racist wing of the upper middle class, votes for them. And middle and low income people, more often than the upper income people, just don't vote because they don't think either party cares about them. So, you know, that if the Green Party is ever going to be a majority governing party, it's the working class that's got to be its base.
Do you see changes? Do you see a lot of changes for 2020?
Well, I think the biggest change is the Green New Deal is being discussed. Medicare for All is got momentum. I don't think I don't think the Democrats will deliver on those things. I mean, we know Nancy Pelosi, the leader of the, you know, in the House for the Democrats, she's in the Speaker of the House. She spoke with private insurance companies saying, don't worry about it. We're not going to do this. Schumer in the Senate doesn't want to do it. So we're not going to get Medicare for All. And the Green New Deal, she kind of dismissed it as the Green Dream. And maybe you saw the Dianne Feinstein, another staunch liberal, so-called liberal in the Democratic Party, you know, condescending to those children that say, do something for our future. And, you know, so I think what's changed is these issues have broad support and people know it, and the Democratic candidates feel compelled to at least address it in some way or other, which means, you know, the advocates of these things, Medicare for All and the Green New Deal, need to keep advocating for the real Medicare for All and the real Green New Deal.
So as the presidential campaign unfolds, will you come back on All Exits Closed to share your thoughts?
Of course.
Great. So you have been listening to Howie Hawkins, and this is All Exits Closed. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Thanks, Howie, and thank you, everybody, for listening. Have a great day.